Jamie, do you understand?
Chapter 43. Vasily moved down a dark and smoke-filled hallway, his team around him. With one hand he held a pistol out in front of him, and with the other he held his walkie-talkie to his mouth. He spoke between coughs.
Anna one for Phantom. How copy?
Oleg Utkin was standing in front of the Black Pearl in a crowd 200 strong, watching the activity as fire trucks pulled into position and men and women covered with soot continued staggering out the door.
Loud and clear, Anna One. What is your status?
We're fucked, Phantom. I've got one dead, one injured that we are carrying, and two walking wounded. We need to make a hasty exfil down the fire escape, but we can't see down to ground level from our position. Get to the west side of the building and make sure the alleyway is clear of hostiles.
Roger that,
Utkin said. Then he crossed the street to the west and peered down the dark alley. In the distance, out of the lights of the intersection, a few attractive young women staggered arm in arm out of the alleyway. He thought they might have been the hookers he saw with Shamroon earlier. Behind them, the fire escape was clear, and he saw no one else in the alley.
Anna One, confirm you are clear to the west.
Utkin couldn't be certain, but he wasn't going any deeper in that alleyway to check it out. No, he'd been here waiting for a report from Zaslan, and now that he had it, he knew he needed to get clear of the area before the cops started pulling people out of the crowd to ask what they saw. There was an emergency rally point for the Russian task force just 2 blocks away, and he'd go there. Vasily came back over the radio.
How the hell could you have checked the alley that fast?
Phantom snapped back at the macho asshole on the radio.
I said it's clear. I'll meet you at Rally Point Boris. I'll get the van ready to roll. Out.
The Chinese asset kneeling between the garbage cans in the alley on the west side of the building had been watching the fire escape for the past 15 minutes, but other than a group of 4 half-naked, soot-covered women in bare feet, no one had come down. He found this surprising because smoke poured out of the windows of the building, and he'd heard the transmissions from the men fighting on the top floor. There, a wounded but still in command Major Shi had announced that the Russians had aggressed out of the battle, but the man between the garbage cans had not seen a trace of them. Suddenly, he heard the noise of squeaking metal several stories above him. Seconds later, he detected movement up there in the darkness. One big dark form moving very slowly down. It wasn't until they passed the 3rd floor landing and started down to the 2nd that he was able to see individual shapes in the mass. Still, he wasn't exactly sure what he was looking at. Finally, he realized the men above him were big and western-looking. He could see weapons among them, and they were carrying one of their number by his shoulders and legs. The man squatting in the alley pressed the button on his radio.
This is Yi Sheng, west side. I have 6 Guelo descending the fire escape. 1 is injured.
The call came quickly.
Yi Sheng, this is Major Shi. Engage them. You will have to do it alone. We are escaping to the nightclub and still engaging the Thais.
Yi Sheng was a Ministry of Defense operative and a former PLA Special Forces sergeant, and this, plus the fact that he had a tactical advantage over the men descending the fire escape, made him confident in taking on the superior number. But it didn't matter if he was confident or not. Major Shi worked for Colonel Dai, which meant failure to comply with Shi's order would mean certain death. Yi Sheng sighted his fully automatic weapon on the head of the first man in the line, tracked it for an instant, and wondered if he was about to press a trigger for the last time in his life. Yi Sheng opened fire. Peter carried Yevgeny by the legs and was just looking back to make the turn at the landing that would take him to the ladder. The plan was to lower the injured man on Ruslan's back, which would probably mean both would fall several feet into the alley. But it was a hell of a lot better than staying in the burning building. Just as Peter turned back and adjusted his grip on Yevgeny's ankles, his head snapped to the side, and he tumbled the half-light down, crashing onto the wounded man and pulling Ruslan over with him. An automatic weapon boomed in the alleyway. Arseny took rounds to both legs, then fell off the side of the stairs, down 2 flights, landing on his shoulder, snapping his neck instantly. Vasily saw the origin of fire below, down between the garbage cans, and he turned his BNT submachine gun to engage it, but before he could press his trigger, he felt a hammer blow to his right hip. A second strike to his right thigh sent him tumbling forward on the staircase, tumbling over the top of Yevgeny and barreling down through Ruslan, who was just trying to get his gun up to fire after falling down where Peter had crashed into him. In seconds, the five Russian operatives fell into one massive heap on the first floor landing. Every last one of them was dead or injured, but those with any life in them at all struggled frantically to get their weapons pointed at the source of the gunfire. Oleg Utkin heard the shooting from the alley he'd just left. A single weapon firing automatically and unsuppressed indicated to his trained ear that his team had just been ambushed.
Thermo,
he mumbled to himself. Then he picked up the pace. He'd get to the RP and he'd wait for the men, and if they didn't show up, he'd drive out of here, keep on driving till daylight, and get himself over the border. This shit wasn't his doing. He'd been ordered into a fucked-up operation in progress, so he wasn't going to take the blame when it fell apart around him. Court gentry followed the blood trail of Nanapan Shamroon all the way from the changing area on the fourth floor down to the second floor. This would have been tough enough in any conditions, considering he was looking for individual drops of blood, sometimes separated by 10 or more feet. But compounding the difficulty was the fact that he had to keep a head up for hostiles, and the rooms and halls were roiling with noxious gray smoke. In the hall on the second floor, which served as offices and storage for the nightclub below, he found the body of a gunman who appeared to Court to be Chinese. Rolling him over quickly, Court saw that the man had a pair of bullet holes center mass in his chest. Court also found the holster for a revolver under his jacket, but there was no sign of the weapon itself. In the man's pocket, Court found a speed loader with 5 .38 special cartridges. Court assumed the woman who'd just stolen his Glock had also picked herself up a backup gun. Court searched the body a moment more, passing on the man's phone and wallet, but when his hands grasped hold of a black Mont Blanc pen, he pulled it out and looked it over quickly. Yes, it was the same kind of scopolamine hydrobromide blowgun that the Chinese operatives had tried to use on him back in Hong Kong. He hadn't taken one before when he had the chance, but now he slipped the device into his pocket, thinking it possible it could come in handy as he tried to track down Fan Qiang. Court continued following a blood trail, and it led him to the body of Nanapan Shamroon in a room full of tables and chairs. By turning on the overhead light in the smoky room, he could see that the 28-year-old had been shot right between the eyes. The American knew instantly the blonde had been after information from the man, and it seemed clear enough that she got what she needed. And with this, Court knew what he had to do now. He had to find the blonde, because he was certain she'd be looking for Fawn, and she now knew more than he did. Court went back out into the hallway and started for the main stairs, but in seconds he was met by a group of firemen coming in his direction. One of the firemen placed a gas mask on Court's face, and he sucked in the air greedily. While the other firefighters continued on through the second floor, Court and his rescuer moved down the hallway to a window on the eastern side of the building, where Court saw a red ladder truck. He crawled down the ladder, leaving the firefighter behind in the building. Once Court was on the ground, a Thai police officer rushed up to him and frisked him perfunctorily. He felt the pen in his pocket but ignored it, and in seconds Court was being patted on the back by a sympathetic cop and directed to an ambulance that had just set up on the corner. Court thanked the policeman and walked towards the ambulance, but when the cop turned away, Court bypassed the vehicle. 3 minutes later, he was climbing into his rented Toyota four-door up the street, wiping sweat and soot off his face, and drinking a bottle of water to clear his throat. He gave himself only 45 seconds to rest, then he fired up the engine and headed back towards the Black Pearl. Zoya Zakharova had made it all the way down into the nightclub carrying 2 pistols in her hands, but when she saw a purse left unattended on the floor by someone who'd raced out of the building, she scooped it up to hide her weapons. She then joined up with a group of civilian stragglers. Most had been hiding in a woman's restroom, and a few had taken cover behind one of the bars on the mezzanine. But firefighters and police had arrived, and Zoya blended in with the mixed crowd of both Thai and foreign clubbers, and the police cordoning off the building outside didn't even glance at the blonde in the skimpy teal dress as she began walking barefoot down the street and away from the action. She had no intention of leaving the scene, however. She knew from her intuition and experience that Vasily's team would take the fire escape down to ground level if they felt they could do it covertly, or else they would try to use grappling hooks to cross the alleyway to the nearby roof. As soon as she noticed that the buildings on both sides were higher than the one that held the Black Pearl, and therefore their roofs would be harder to reach, she felt sure they'd risk the fire escape. She turned into the alleyway on the west side and found it dark and empty-looking, and she saw the metal stairs attached to the building some 40 meters ahead. Smoke poured out of the windows on several floors, obstructing her view. As she looked on, a window exploded on the second floor, showering part of the alley with broken glass. She moved closer, waiting for a break in the smoke, and wondered if perhaps Vasily and his team were still caught inside. Then she saw it. On the second floor landing, she noticed a massive form lying there. Even from 40 meters away, she could tell she was looking at a pile of bodies. Zoya slipped around a tape line erected by the fire department and sprinted barefoot into the alley. By the time she made it around the broken glass and to the fire escape, she could see that three of the men from the Zaslan team were lying on the asphalt below the ladder, and three more were piled in a heap above her. Nearby, a Chinese man in a business suit lay against the wall of the building opposite the Black Pearl, between two garbage cans. He appeared dead, and an HK rifle lay by his side. Zoya looked back over her shoulder quickly, making sure no one on the street behind her had entered the alley. When she saw the coast was clear, she lifted a suppressed Brugger and Tomet subgun from Arseny's still form and shot the Chinese body twice in the head at a range of 15 feet. Dropping the weapon, she knelt over Arseny. The Russian operator was dead with gunshot wounds and a broken neck. She moved quickly to Ruslan and found him alive but unconscious. She saw that he had been shot on the right side of his pelvis, and his left arm was badly broken. Zoya wondered if he had fallen or dropped intentionally from the landing above. Vasily was the third man lying in the alley. His legs and lower torso had been shot several times. He was conscious, but barely. As she leaned over him, he looked at her with confusion.
Koshka.
She pulled the medical kit from Ruslan's tactical vest under his jacket and yanked out a tourniquet. With it, she began cinching Vasily's right leg, and while she worked, she asked,
"The others?"
Vasily looked up at the fire escape landing above him. He shook his head.
"You are certain they are all dead?"
He nodded now. Then he said,
"What are you doing here?"
Zoya did not answer. She wrapped the tourniquet around his upper leg, tightened it just below his crotch, and then yanked as hard as she could to completely cut off the blood flow. Vasily yelled out while she tied it off, but she covered his mouth with a free hand. When he recovered, the Zaslan commander said,
"Phantom. Where's Phantom?"
Zoya knew another officer from the SVR would have replaced her, but she was surprised to hear Vasily use the codename of Oleg Utkin. Utkin was known as a competent officer, but she'd personally never thought much of him as a leader. He was the guy SVR sent in to wine and dine foreign turncoats, not to run a task force of Zaslan snake-eaters. She assumed he must have just been the closest, most senior operative at the time Zoya was relieved of command, so Moscow had sent him here to pick up the operation where she left it.
"Fucking fools," she thought.
Fan Xiong was too important a mission to hand over to Oleg Utkin. She grabbed Vasily's walkie-talkie off his belt and depressed the talk key.
"Phantom, this is Sarina. How do you copy?"
She put down the radio and kept working on Vasily, then checked on Ruslan again. Finally, Utkin replied through the little speaker.
"What are you doing on this net?"
Zoya picked up the radio again.
"I'm on Anna One's radio. Where the fuck are you?"
"I'm at the RP.
You have a vehicle?"
"Of course we have vehicles. We have two here. The Anna team has a minibus, and I have a two-door Audi."
Zoya replied coldly.
"Well, you'll only need the car. There are two survivors. Get to the alleyway west of the Black Pearl now. Hurry!"
Chapter 44. Court sat parked 75 yards away from the blonde woman in the skimpy teal dress. Through the binoculars he'd pulled from his go-pack on the front seat next to him, he could see the woman on her bare knees in the narrow alley, treating one of the two men lying there. He wondered if she still had the Glock and the 38 on her. Her teal mini-dress was form-fitting with a high-rise waistline, so it certainly didn't lend itself to hiding 2 pounds of steel, polymer, and ammo. But Court couldn't see well enough into the dark alley from here, and for all he knew, she could have taped or tied the weapons to her thighs if she had to. Or she might have had a purse she laid next to the men that he couldn't see from here. While she continued to work alone in the dark below the fire escape, flames and smoke poured out of the windows of the building right next to her. Everyone else, civilians, police, firefighters, were all staying out of the alley because of the danger there. But Court knew the blonde wasn't going to remain undetected for long, because she was just 40 or 50 yards from the intersection on the opposite side of the block from Court. And there, a Bangkok fire department truck and a crowd of onlookers were in plain view, and she was in plain view of them if they took the time to shine a light up the alley. As Court focused again on the woman performing immediate action first aid on the two prostrate figures, a black Audi coupe rolled up to the mouth of the alleyway between Court and the blonde, just half a block from the American's Toyota four-door. The Audi turned into the alley but stopped abruptly, likely because of the fire and the narrowness of the channel between the buildings. A man climbed out of the driver's side door, then knelt and pulled his seat forward to access the back seats in the coupe. He left his door open as he jogged off up the alley. Court realized instantly this was the man he'd pegged as an SVR operative in the nightclub earlier. Clearly he'd left the car door open because he planned on carrying the injured men to his car. Court looked at the open back door on the far side of the man's vehicle, then quickly pulled one of his phones out of his pack along with the Bluetooth earpiece he'd bought with it, and he climbed out of his Toyota. He took off in a sprint for the Audi. As he ran, he dialed the number of his other phone. He'd written it on a piece of tape affixed to the back of the device, and then he paired that phone with the Bluetooth earpiece. As soon as he got to the car, he ducked down behind it and looked up the alley. And here he saw that the man in the suit and the blonde were both kneeling over one of the men lying on his back. Court reached into the Audi and crammed the cell phone under the driver's seat, then took the tiny Bluetooth earpiece and wedged it between the driver's headrest and the seat back, careful to position the device so only the microphone tip was visible, and then only to someone really looking for it. Court spun back out of the Audi, then ran back for his own car in a crouch. Oleg Utkin knelt down over Vasily and Ruslan, but he did not render first aid. Instead, he looked up at the bright intersection ahead, which was crowded with firefighters. He slowly surveyed the alley around him. A dead Chinese man in a black suit was crumpled against the wall between some metal garbage cans. He asked,
"Where is the rest of Anna?"
Zoya pointed up, and Utkin looked to the fire escape. There, just a few meters over his head, Peter, Yevgeny, and Andrei all lay there in a heap, their bodies a twisted mass. Blood dripped down from multiple locations, missing Oleg by no more than a couple of feet. Zoya said,
"Before he passed out, Vasily said Mikhail was killed on the fourth floor."
"Dermo, how bad are they?"
he asked, referring to the two survivors.
"They'll survive if we get them to a hospital."
She had removed their guns and gear and radios, Ruslan's body armor, and the extra magazines she found in Vasily's pockets. She threw the equipment over by the dead Chinese operative. Oleg knelt down and started to lift Vasily. Zoya said,
"What are you doing?"
"Taking him to the car. Get his legs."
"I just told you they need a hospital."
She stood up, waved to the firefighters 40 meters away on the well-lit street, and shouted for them to help. Oleg said,
"No! These men can't be interviewed by police!"
He started to heave Vasily up alone, but Zoya grabbed Utkin by the arm and spun him to face her.
"They'll die!"
Utkin said,
"Then they'll die! I have my orders. No compromise!"
But Bangkok firefighters had heard Zoya, and they were already running over. Zoya found one who spoke some English, and she showed the man the wounds on the two men. He immediately spoke into his radio while other firemen grabbed the victims to pull them farther away from the burning building, closer to the dead Chinese gunman. The fireman stared in astonishment at all the weapons and bullet holes in the four men, and Zoya realized they hadn't even seen the dead men on the fire escape's landing. Zoya walked over to Ruslan and Vasily and said some soft, soothing words in English while she appeared to hug them one after the other, in plain view of the firemen, but in truth she was fishing around for their mobile phones, both of which she pulled off of them. Utkin just stood there in the dark, fuming. Zoya stood and walked over to him and spoke softly in Russian.
Where is your car?
Right there.
He pointed up to the corner, behind the building where the Audi sat with its back door open. Zoya said,
Let's go.
Where?
But she was already heading to the car.
Away from here.
A minute later, the Audi raced through the nearly empty streets, heading north. Hundreds of yards behind them, Kort followed along with his earpiece in his ear and his mobile phone broadcasting anything said inside the vehicle, though the sound wasn't great and Kort's Russian was far from perfect. He also had the screen of his mobile in his lap displaying an application that showed him the location of the other phone, a feature he'd taken pains to set up the day before, knowing that with this app the phone could be used as both a surveillance device and a tracking device. The conversation in the Audi had involved a good bit of shouting, mostly from the man behind the wheel. Kort could tell the man was driving because his voice was much closer to the microphone. It was hard for Kort to understand them at first, but as he tuned into their voices, his comprehension improved. The argument hinged on whether it was the right call to hand the survivors of their group over to the Thai authorities. The blonde insisted she had no choice, and the big man chastised her, saying this was his operation and she had no authority to do what she had done. The two Russians went a full minute without speaking, and then the man said,
I was warned you might show up. You were ordered to return to Moscow. You have no business here.
The woman did not reply to this.
And what the hell are you wearing? You infiltrated the Shamroon Syndicate dressed as a whore? Your father would be so proud of you. Fuck you, Oleg. Seriously, your presence here has compromised. Why are we talking about me? Your whole team was just wiped out while under your command. And that's my fault? I reported what I saw and they went in. Where were you when Vasily's team took fire?
I was upstairs in the middle of the firefight.
A pause.
Where the hell were you?
I don't answer to you, Sarina.
Da, you're right. You answer to Lubyanka. In fact, why don't we just call them right now?
There was another significant pause. Kort could tell the man was looking to deflect blame onto the girl, who was clearly an SVR operative herself, and who was already in trouble with her masters. The driver then said,
What did you learn in there?
The woman answered,
Natapong Shamroon is dead in the nightclub. His brother Kulap is the one with Fan. He is on the move with him now. I know where they are going.
Where did you learn this?
Natapong told me.
You just said he was... Oh. I see. Where is Kulap taking Fan?
Kort cocked his head in the trailing vehicle when the woman called Sarina didn't answer. The man behind the wheel said,
Listen, Sarina, I came here for intel and I'm going to get it.
Is that some sort of a threat?
She asked.
This has been a costly evening already. I'm just suggesting you don't make it worse.
Kort listened in as he drove, concentrating on every word to understand. He could not see the vehicle ahead of him, but on his phone he could tell they'd just turned left on Rama 9 Road. Kort was a minute behind them at least, but he didn't want or need to get any closer. The woman replied,
I'll talk to Lubyanka after you drop me off.
The hell you will.
The man said a woman's name now, but Kort couldn't pick it up. He thought it might have been Stoya.
I can blame you and put this entire affair behind me.
Ha! Huh. She said, clearly not taking him as seriously as Kort took the threat.
Too bad for you, Ruslan and Vasily are still alive.
They'll cover for me,
Oleg said coldly.
You're insane,
Sarina said.
I'll make a deal with you, though.
I'm listening.
You know how important it is to get Fan back. You also know that the minute Lubyanka finds out what happened tonight, on top of what happened in Vietnam, they will pull us out of the field.
The man said,
Have you forgotten they did that to you already?
The woman ignored Oleg, and Kurt listened to the passion in her voice.
Damn it, Oleg Petrovich! I am just asking for you to come help me now. I know where Fan is going, and we can get him. Then we can contact Moscow. Otherwise, all this has been for nothing.
Kurt liked the intensity of this woman, even if she worked for the wrong team. He caught himself rooting for her to win her argument. But when Oleg did not reply, Kurt started to worry. And when he saw on his GPS phone tracker that the car was pulling off the road and stopping, his concern only grew. The woman spoke in confusion now, but not in alarm.
Dejoto!
What the hell? He heard a struggle, banging and grunting, and then the woman screamed,
Подожди! Нет! Не надо!
Wait, no, don't do it. A gunshot cracked in Kurt's earpiece, and he floored the gas pedal, racing towards the blip on his tracking app, a half mile ahead. Chapter 45. Whatever had taken place inside the Audi between the two Russian spies, it was over by the time Kurt arrived. He pulled up behind the vehicle a minute later with his headlights off, and he stayed 50 yards back, though he wanted to drive right up to the rear bumper. But since he was unarmed, and since he didn't know what the situation was inside the black coupe ahead, he decided he could not get any closer. He'd heard a total of 3 gunshots over the speakerphone and sounds of a brutal struggle, but in the last 20 seconds, all had been perfectly silent. He wondered if both Russians had been shot, but as he peered into the dark car parked next to the sidewalk on the 2-lane residential street, he saw the driver's side door open. First, a pistol fell out of the door, clanked on the asphalt, and lay still. Then, it seemed as if the man called Oleg was going to climb out. Kurt saw his head and left shoulder emerge from the car, but then his entire body just tipped sideways and rolled out, and he fell head first on top of the gun. His lower torso was pushed or kicked until his entire body was out of the car and lying still on the street. Kurt heard the woman's voice in his earpiece now.
Mudak,
asshole. And then the car door closed and the Audi raced off on squealing tires. Kurt waited for the Audi's taillights to disappear in the darkness, and then he drove on, keeping an eye on the GPS phone. He was surprised by her voice again in his ear just 5 minutes later. She'd made a phone call, obviously, but Kurt would have to concentrate on her half of the conversation to work out who she was speaking with.
It's Sarina.
A pause.
Identity code.
She said a long string of numbers, but Kurt couldn't follow them, and wouldn't remember them 5 seconds later anyway. He followed the blip on his mobile app, careful to keep his speed down and his eyes on the road. A moment later, the woman said,
That doesn't matter. I'm in Bangkok, as I'm sure you will work out quickly. Anna 1 and Anna 8 have been taken to a hospital. All the rest are dead. Yes, Phantom included.
Kurt knew that for Russians, Anna was akin to Alpha in the NATO phonetic alphabet. He presumed the dead gunfighters were all part of Team A of whatever unit they belonged to. After a brief pause, she entered into a back-and-forth with the other caller where she refused to give any information about herself, why she was there, or how she knew the status of the Anna team. After this, she regained control of the conversation.
Listen carefully. I know where Fun is going. Don't ask me how. Just know that I will go, get positive ID, and contact you. Have another team prepped to travel.
After a moment's pause, she said,
You aren't listening to me. This operation is too important. We have to do something to blunt China's rise. Beijing will swallow up all of Asia in a couple of years. Russia can't stop them, and America won't. If we can get to Fan before the Chinese kill him, get him to work for us, then it could have incredible implications. China's secure intelligence and defense networks exposed? Their classified operations and personnel revealed? Forget Russia. This is the best opportunity the West will ever get to tip the balance in our favor.
The woman was silent for the next minute, other than a couple of unsuccessful attempts to interrupt the person on the other line. Finally, she said,
You are making a mistake. The Americans were there tonight, not in force,
but they are in a better position to take Fan than we are, unless you sanction me to continue the operation.
After another pause, Court heard a sound that told him she'd hung up her phone and dropped it on the seat next to her. Another sound, he guessed, was the Russian woman pounding the steering wheel in frustration. A minute later, the blip on his mobile tracking app stopped moving. Zoya Zakharova knew it was a compromise bringing Oleg Utkin's vehicle and gear to her room here at the big youth hostel in the Bang Rock neighborhood. But she wasn't terribly worried, because she also knew how the SVR task force had been operating. Utkin might have tracking devices on his gear or in his rental car, but the Lubyenka would just now be looking for his vehicle. Once they did pinpoint the GPS coordinates of his car, it would still take security officers from the local residency an hour at minimum to muster up a team to go to the location in force. And Zoya only planned on being in her room here at the hostel for 10 minutes to shower and change and grab her gear. She entered the building with a master key given to each of the hostel's guests, and then she walked down to her room at the end of a long hallway. She entered with another key, flipped on the light, and then stepped into the bathroom to turn on the shower. While she waited for the water to warm, she removed her blonde wig with the long bangs, slipped off her torn and blood-stained teal dress and her sweat-soaked underwear, and tore off her fake eyelashes. She looked in the bathroom mirror now and saw blood splatter across her face from where she'd turned Oleg Utkin's pistol against him during the fight. She was still coming to grips with the fact that the prick had tried to kill her, but she knew she had to push that out of her mind so she could figure out the other aspects of the night that still did not make sense. She took the stolen Glock 17 out of the stolen purse and put it on the sink within easy reach of her in the shower, and she pulled the 5-shot 38 revolver and brought it with her into the shower, placing it on a tiny soap ledge. She washed herself as quickly as possible, using a copious amount of cheap industrial liquid soap out of a pump bottle attached to the wall, and while she did so, she thought back to what she could not help feeling was the most confusing part of the night. The American. The man who'd risked his life to come back for her and the other girls, with no possible benefit to his objective. In fact, the stranger had completely sacrificed his mission by returning to Zoya and the others, although he hadn't known that was what he was doing at the time.
But why?
The man seemed to be operating completely alone, and this was not the modus operandi of the U.S. intelligence services. Zoya had spent over a decade on foreign jobs where knowledge of the CIA's operating protocol was necessary to her completion of the mission. And this man's actions didn't look like a CIA job at all. Some non-official cover operatives working with the agency might function in a singleton capacity, but they sure as hell wouldn't hit a nightclub with dozens of armed men while flying solo. But what this American did, that took balls. She thought about him racing into the gunfire several times to rescue the girls, and she thought about how she'd left him there in the changing area, stealing both his gun and his captive. She felt like shit about what she'd done, and this was a strange feeling for her. She wondered what happened to him, and then, at the moment she realized she couldn't really remember what he looked like, she realized this was probably the same American she saw sitting at the bar on Po Toi Island a week and a half earlier. He had been in the middle of Wo Xing Wo there. He was in the middle of the Shamroon Syndicate here. So it was only natural to wonder if he'd been the mysterious man who'd absconded with Phan in Vietnam. Why not? He certainly seemed crazy enough to do that on his own as well. Zoya had spared his life tonight because he'd helped the other women. She had spent 2 full days with victimized African and European human traffic victims, and while the first day she had wanted to wring some of their stupid necks herself, over time, she had developed an odd bond with them. Still, she didn't know if she would run through gunfire multiple times to save them. Zoya turned off the shower just after a minute and a half, and then she reached out to grab the towel. She started drying herself off, pushed the plastic curtain out of the way to climb out, and then dropped straight down to the floor of the shower onto her knees, grabbing the revolver off the ledge as she went down. She extended the pistol in a combat crouch in front of her, pointed it back towards her room, and held her breath. The Glock 17 was gone from the sink, and the bathroom door was now closed. After a few seconds, a voice came from outside the door, speaking English.
If you toss the 38 out, I'll throw in your clothes.
Zoya recognized the American's voice, and she knew he was in her room now, along with the pistol she'd stolen from him. She didn't know what to do. There was no good place for her to get behind cover in this tiny bathroom. Sure, she could open fire into her room, blast through the flimsy wooden door, but he had more room to maneuver for cover than she did, less space to fire into, and more bullets in his weapon, so he would have all the advantages in that fight. With the presence of mind to use her Hungarian-accented English, she called out to him.
What do you want?
I just told you what I wanted. Shall I repeat it?
Zoya cocked her head. There was a surprising composure in the man's voice, considering the two of them now held each other at gunpoint at a distance of 3 meters. The door opened a foot, but the lights in her room were off.
Toss it out, and I throw in some clothes.
No deal,
she said.
I can fight naked. I can't fight without a gun.
The American's response came quickly. It was loud enough to be heard, but soft enough so that she was unable to pinpoint just where in the room the man was standing.
I'm trying to avoid a fight. Trust me, Serena. This is the best deal you're gonna get from me.
How the hell does he know my code name?
After a few seconds, her shoulders dropped, and she lowered the handgun. She opened the cylinder of the 38 Special and let the 5 rounds fall to the floor in the shower. They made a clinking sound that would have been obvious to anyone out in the bedroom. Then she put the revolver on the floor in front of her and slid it out through the opening in the door and into the room.
Thank you, came the voice. And then, are you ready?
What?
The door opened a little further, and a few seconds later, a black V-neck T-shirt and a pair of jeans tumbled through the air. Zoya caught the items, noticed there was no underwear, and just as she was about to say something about that, she heard the disembodied voice again.
Oh, sorry.
Folded underwear out of her backpack came sailing in. The door was then pulled shut. Zoya wondered if the man had tied a string to the latch, because she'd neither seen nor heard anyone move inside the room.
No rush, said the American,
and she detected sarcasm in the statement. Zoya thought this had to have been one of the strangest things she'd ever experienced in the field. A minute later, she was dressed, though her feet were bare, and her chin-length dark hair was still wet and tousled, half tucked behind her ears and half drooping in her face. She opened the door slowly and saw that the lights had been turned back on.
Come out slowly, hands high.
She raised her hands, stepped out, and looked into the eyes of the American she'd seen earlier in the night. He stood in front of the door to the hall. The big Glock pistol was low in his hands, but when he saw that her hands were empty, he slid the pistol into his waistband at the small of his back. She lowered her own hands and looked the man over. He was in his 30s, perhaps 31, perhaps 39. He had brown hair, cut short but not severely so, an athletic build, and eyes that might have been brown, hazel, or amber. He wasn't particularly tall. His clean-shaven face was pleasant enough, but in no way descript, and his expression was impossibly calm, considering all that had happened tonight, and everything she had put him through. There was a little dark soot on the man's face, but he'd changed clothes into a gray T-shirt and black cotton pants. Zoya still used the Hungarian accent she'd been employing the past few days.
Who are you?
She felt sure her nervousness was obvious in her voice.
You know who I am, because I'm the one who wasn't wearing a blonde wig and 10 layers of makeup tonight. I want to talk to you.
She shook her head.
I have nothing to say.
The man now asked,
Maybe I'll just hang out here till you change your mind. How much time before someone comes here looking for you?
Other than yourself, you mean?
You know what I mean. From the residency.
I don't know what you...
I placed a bug in Oleg's car.
Then he switched into English-accented Russian.
Я говорю по-русски.
I speak Russian. And with that, she muttered,
Dermo.
I'll ask you again.
How long do you have before they come for you? She sighed a little, sure she shouldn't be talking, but unable to see what it mattered at this point. He was here, and he knew who she was and what had happened. She let her Hungarian accent drift off, and her very light Russian accent appeared.
I need to leave now.
I wouldn't take the Audi.
No kidding.
The man smiled a little, but he did not move. Zoya said,
Well, if you came looking for Natapong, as you can see, I'm not hiding him anywhere.
The American replied, I found Natapong where you left him. I'm no doctor, but I don't think he's going to be much help to me. Zoya swallowed. Yes, now she understood the American's plan here. He had come to torture her for the intel she picked up from Shamroon so he could get his hands on Fan Xiang. She wondered if he'd kill her when he was done. She gauged the distance between herself and the door, and the distance between herself and the man with the gun in the small of his back. She thought she could get to him before he got the weapon out, but she found herself unwilling to try. He wasn't particularly big, and he had not threatened her overtly, except by his presence here. But Zoya knew what this man had done tonight, part of it, anyway. And he'd certainly be wired to suspect some sort of resistance on her part. And he'd be ready for it. To her surprise, he said, I'm here to ask for your help. With suspicion in her voice, she asked,
What kind of help?
First, let's take my car and get out of here. We'll go somewhere safe, then we can talk. The Russian girl with the wet dark hair looked down to the floor, bit her lip, and then shrugged a little.
You have the gun, so I will agree to your terms.
Good.
But I have to pack first.
The American lifted her bag off the bed and onto his shoulder without taking his eyes from her. He said, I took the liberty of packing for you while you were in the shower, and since I'm a gentleman, I'll go ahead and carry this bag that has two folding knives and a switchblade in the outer pockets.
How very nice of you,
Zoya said, and she realized she was now a prisoner of the Central Intelligence Agency. Chapter 46 Court drove a Toyota Vios, essentially a newer Tercel made for and marketed to the Southeast Asian market. He moved his own big pack into the back seat and threw the Russian woman's bag in next to it. He moved his pistol from the small of his back to his left side, then climbed behind the wheel while she got into the passenger side. Court said, I'm not going to tie you up, and I'm not going to hold a gun on you. I need to earn your trust. So, I'm just going to ask you very nicely not to jump out of the car until you hear what I have to say. After we talk, if you want me to drop you off somewhere, I will do as you ask. The woman said,
Right.
Court could tell she didn't believe him. As he pulled away from the youth hostel, she looked around at the little gray four-door.
I would have expected the agency to give you a nicer car.
The agency? You mean the car rental agency? The Russian just stared at the American for a moment, then asked,
Where are we going?
It will be dawn soon. I'll get us a hotel room, someplace near the airport where it won't look strange to show up so early. We'll get checked in, and then we'll sit and talk. Are you hungry? We can find some food first, but I don't want to talk in public. The woman shook her head.
No, I am not hungry.
Court said, Well, I'm starving, and like you said, I've got the gun.
I could eat something, I guess.
30 minutes later, they were checked in at the Novotel Suvarnabhumi, within sight of the airport runways at Bangkok Suvarnabhumi International Airport. Before they even took their bags to their room, they sat in the restaurant, their plates full of items from the breakfast buffet. Around them, a few businessmen and businesswomen started their day in small groups, many already talking about work. But Court and Zoya ate mostly in silence, and they drank copious amounts of coffee. Even while Zoya ate her eggs and bit into her toast, she never took her eyes from Court. She was mistrustful, confused about the entire situation, but on top of that, she was trying to commit his face to memory. Court ate a bite of oatmeal, then, apropos of nothing, said, Your colleagues, did any of them make it? Zoya looked down to her plate.
Two. They are injured,
but they should survive.
Friends of yours?
No, I wasn't even working with them tonight.
How many did you lose? The woman seemed hesitant to answer.
Then she gave a little shrug.
5 men died.
I'm sorry. I heard Oleg mention that you were recalled to Moscow, but you didn't go back. Is that true? The Russian woman snapped back now.
If you heard him say that, then you have your answer, don't you?
She chewed her toast slowly, still looking hard across the table. When Kurt said nothing to this, she said,
I was down here on my own, trying to help. Obviously, I failed.
Kurt sipped his coffee.
That's not obvious to me. Your team walked into a buzzsaw tonight. There was a unit of well-trained operatives from the Chinese mainland hitting at the same time your countrymen did. And the Shamroon Syndicate hires its security officers from only 2 places. Aranthira 26, which is the Royal Thai Police Federal SWAT team, and... The Russian woman interrupted him.
And the underwater demolition assault unit of the Royal Thai Navy. SEALs, basically.
Kurt said, Sounds like you did your homework. Your friend shouldn't have hit that fortified location.
I'll tell them if they ever get out of surgery. Of course, that will be difficult because they'll be in a Thai prison.
Kurt called for the check and got 2 full cups of coffee to go, and then the two of them went upstairs to the room. It was a small suite with a living room with a sofa and chairs divided by a door to the bedroom and the bathroom. Kurt tossed the packs against the wall, then sat down across from the Russian in the little sitting area. She asked,
Do you want to clean up first? I can still see the soot from the fire on your face.
Kurt shook his head.
I'm pretty sure you will walk out if I turn my back.
Why would I do that? You have some amazing proposal to offer me, and I'm free to leave at any time.
She said it with obvious skepticism. Kurt smiled a little.
Oleg called you by name, but I couldn't understand it.
Just call me Serena.
That's a shitty code name.
Zoya did not respond to this, and Kurt thought a moment.
Serena Vostoshoi Travogi. Your code name is Banshee.
She neither confirmed nor denied, but Kurt didn't wait for her to do either.
That's better than Serena.
What is your name?
She asked.
I'm Bob.
Right. I'm Jane.
I like Banshee,
Kurt said.
You told Oleg, and you told your handler, that you found out where Fawn is being held.
Zoya said,
I just told them that to get them to help me. The truth is, Natapong didn't talk.
So you just gave up and shot him?
That's right.
You don't strike me as a quitter.
Zoya looked right at Kurt, but said nothing. He switched gears.
I saw you at the Wild Tiger safe house in Vietnam, climbing the wall of the villa.
Without blinking, Zoya said,
If you saw me, why didn't you shoot me?
I couldn't. I was laying low, impersonating a plant.
I'm sure you were very convincing.
She lifted her chin a little.
And I saw you on Po Toi Island. You sat at the bar, pretended to be British, and you asked the bartender something about some men you were looking for. It made him nervous, and it made me curious.
Kurt's eyes narrowed.
I don't.
With a slow nod, Kurt just stared at her, dumbfounded.
You wore a leather headband?
The woman nodded.
I thought you were about 19.
Who says I'm not?
Who was the other woman?
From Germany, I think she said. I met her on the ferry and attached myself to her. Thought I'd look less suspicious that way.
It worked, confirmed Kurt.
It usually does. My hippie girl traveling with others is my best third world cover.
Better than the Hungarian hooker?
They both have their place.
With a challenging tone, she said,
How about you, Bob? What's your best alias?
Quiet guy who asks a lot of questions but doesn't answer many.
She gave him a quizzical look, but said,
And are you in character now?
Actually, this is the real me. I want to know where Fan Xiang is being held.
Zoya looked out the window. Kurt said,
You seem nervous being here with me. If I posed a real threat to you, do you really think I'd take you from your hotel, bring you here, and buy you breakfast? You are in danger, sure, but not from me. I wish you would relax a little so we could talk freely.
Zoya thought about what the man had said, but she did not let her guard down.
Obviously you saved my life tonight, and obviously I took advantage of your kindness, stole your gun, and your prisoner.
And you threw me over your hip, don't forget that.
Yes, I did. I have no right to expect anything else from you after what I did.
Court said, I understand the job. You had an objective. I was in the way.
If you understand the job, as you say, then why did you risk rescuing the five of us?
Just because I know what my job is, it doesn't mean I always do it.
Your employer must get very frustrated with you.
You have no idea.
Zoya waved a hand in front of her.
But you seem to be back on mission now, because you are here with me, and you are asking about fun. Why am I not in some CIA rendition facility getting water poured up my nose?
Court chuckled. I don't work for the CIA.
Right.
He leaned forward. I saw what happened last night, and I know that whatever happens to you, you aren't going back to Russia with Fan Xiang to receive a hero's welcome. Any decent investigation by the SVR is going to show that you killed Oleg. The circumstances of why will be irrelevant. I hate to break it to you, but you are no longer an operative with Russian intelligence. She nodded.
No, I am not. But why do you care?
The question is, why should you care about my operation? And I'll tell you. I heard what you said to your handler, and you are absolutely correct. China is a great danger to both of our nations. The USA sees it. Clearly Russia sees it too. We're going to need intelligence from the Chinese intelligence networks, and that kid Fan can do that for us.
We?
I mean the West. China has plans for the world. What you and I do now can help us slow down their dominance, maybe knock them down a few steps.
What do you mean, what you and I do?
You tell me where Kulop Shamroon is hiding Fan Xiang. I go and rescue him. I'll get him away from the Thais and save him from the Chinese before they assassinate him.
Zoya cocked her head.
Why on earth would I help America?
Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't believe you are my enemy. You were thrown off this mission, but you came back on your own, despite the danger. Despite what you knew it would do to your career to defy the Lubyanka. Well, you still have a chance to succeed now. Not for Moscow, but for the West.
How do I know you won't just kill me when I tell you?
Court sighed. Would it help if I handed you my gun now? Would that demonstrate to you I was no threat? Zoya nodded slowly.
That would help a great deal.
Court made no movement towards the pistol tucked under his t-shirt.
Well?
Zoya asked.
You aren't getting a gun. Jesus, lady, I'm a nice guy, but I'm not fucking crazy.
No, I don't believe you are. But I also don't believe you are as heroic as you make yourself out to be. I think you are... What do you guys say in America? I think you are playing me.
You mean you think you are being played?
Yes, that's it.
I just want Fan, and you know where he is. It's as simple as that.
Zoya said,
The truth is, I don't know Fan Xiang's location. Natapong did not know exactly where Fan was being taken, only that Kulap would move Fan and get out of Bangkok because of what was going on at the Black Pearl. He was going someplace where he'd be protected.
Court said,
But you know where.
Natapong told me where he thought his brother would go. Still, I only have the guess of a Thai gangster to go on.
Court said, It's more than I've got. Will you tell me?
Zoya looked at him a long time.
Where is everyone else on your team?
He shrugged. It's just me.
You're a liar.
I'll rephrase that. It's just me on the hunt. I've been told I can call in some help on the ground for the actual rescue, but for now, everyone else is somewhere safer.
Then your colleagues aren't much better than mine.
At least they haven't tried to kill me.
It was a bald-faced lie. The CIA had spent years trying to do just that, but since he was back in their good graces, sort of, and since he was only speaking about this particular mission, he felt he was being honest enough.
Yet,
Zoya said.
Right. Yet, Court allowed.
Finally, she said,
I was given a job, and my job is not completed. I want to go with you. I want to see this operation through to the end.
Court stared at her a long time. Finally, he said,
Agreed. Where do we go to look for him?
Zoya hesitated a moment. She was afraid to play her one card, but finally she said,
Phuket, Thailand.
Chapter 47. For the next hour, Zoya and Court sat in the hotel room and pored over Court's computer looking at maps of Phuket, a few hundred miles south of Bangkok along the ocean. Zoya explained that Natapong's father, Ponnet, owned a large jungle property that ran along the coast. Ponnet was abroad, and Kulap had told his brother he would lay low in Bangkok for a day or two, and then he would go to the Phuket estate. Zoya also explained that Kulap had a helicopter, and if he was, in fact, at the estate, then the Hilo would be there as well. The two operatives used Google Earth to zoom in to the walled property, just inland from the coast. In the center was a large ornate home in the traditional Thai style, surrounded by tropical gardens rimmed by thick jungle on all sides. Less than a half mile west of the property was a large five-star resort. Court and Zoya agreed they would go to the resort, check in under the cover of an American couple, and begin their reconnaissance. It looked like the journey by car from Bangkok to Phuket would take 12 hours if they split up the driving duties, which they agreed to do. They were both dead tired already, but Zoya offered to drive the first leg while Court slept. Court agreed to this as well, but he said he needed to go for a quick walk to make a phone call before they left.
"You are calling your handler, obviously," Zoya said. "Why can't I listen to you? Obviously, you will tell him about me. You will tell him about Fan, and you will tell him about our plan to find him."
Court shook his head. "In this instance, I truly believe that less is more. My handler would be very upset if I revealed I am working with an SVR asset."
"You could tell him I was fired."
Court stood and headed to the door.
"We are a team, you and me, but you'll have to trust me that I know what I'm doing. My handler is..."
"Your handler is a woman, I take it."
Court cocked his head.
"How did you—"
"You keep saying my handler, so as not to give the gender away. You wouldn't do that if your handler were male."
Court was at once pissed at himself for the tell and stunned by her powers of intuition.
"Yes, my handler is a woman."
Zoya said,
"Most men I know would have just lied."
She shrugged.
"It's a bad sign that my new partner gives away his secrets so easily, but maybe it's a good sign that my new partner is at least a little honest with me."
5 minutes later, Court stood in the open parking lot of the Novotel, watching an Airbus A320 take off from the airport just a half mile away. In his hand, he held his mobile, and while he waited for Brewer to come on the line, he thought about the woman upstairs. He wondered if she'd run, now that he wasn't watching her. Of course, he knew he couldn't trust her to stay, and he couldn't be sure she wouldn't call someone. He'd taken her mobile phone from her, but right now, as he stood here, she could have been on the hotel phone calling the police, the Russian embassy, or some other group. There were all sorts of people who could come in and ruin Court's day, and he'd done nothing to prevent Banshee from contacting any of them. But he trusted his instincts, and while his instincts did not tell him to trust her fully, they also told him she wanted the same thing he did, and she was practical enough to realize she needed help to get it. Suzanne Brewer answered the phone with unmasked concern in her voice. It was 10 p.m. on the East Coast, but at this point in the operation, he took it as a given that Brewer would be in her office when he called.
"Identity challenge, dastardly."
"My response is Denver."
"Confirmed. What is your status? Everything I've heard about the Black Pearl has been disconcerting. I was wondering if your body was going to be found in that smoldering building."
"I'm okay, but I have to tell you, your idea about calling the Chinese in to help last night really sucked."
"The Chinese went into the building?"
"The Chinese and the Russians, and God knows how many Thai. Don't worry, I kept a low profile. There are no comebacks on the agency, and I managed to get some intel. From what I learned, Kulap has an estate in Phuket, and he might bring Fan immediately, or else it could take him a couple of days to get there. There is also a Hilo that will be on site if Kulap Shamroon is on the property."
Brewer pulled up satellite data of the area immediately. Looking it over, she said,
"No helicopter on the ground, but the most recent image I have was 4 p.m. yesterday. As soon as I get updated imagery, I'll check again."
Court said,
"I'll be on the ground there by late this evening."
Brewer said,
"Tell me how you got your intel."
Court said,
"Not prepared to do that. Trust that I'm working, and trust that I'll check in as soon as I have something actionable for the team."
And with that, he hung up the phone. He knew he'd just pissed Brewer off, but he had to be careful with what he said. He was calling an audible working with the SVR operative, and he was certain Brewer would disagree with this decision. Next, he dialed Colonel Dai, and he told himself he had to keep his rage with the man under control. Dai opened the conversation with,
"What happened last night?"
From where I was sitting, it looked like your men burned down a building full of innocent people, killed a dozen or more Thai gangsters and a team of Russian paramilitaries, and still managed to fail to accomplish anything. Colonel Dai said,
I lost 7 men in that nightclub.
Then I guess you should have listened to me when I told you to keep them outside.
If my men had not gone in, the Russians would have captured Shamroon, and by now they would